You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The history of the oil and automobile industries has shaped domestic and international capitalism in both positive and negative ways, and that continues to this day, as we learn from a new book called Zoom, The Global Race to Fuel the Car of the Future, by Ian Carson and Vijay Vaithiswaran. It addresses what may be the most important new challenge facing the industrial world, the global race to create automobiles that will run on cleaner energy sources. It's published by 12, an imprint of Hachette Book Group, and I'm very pleased it has brought Vijay Vaithiswaran back to the show today. It's always a pleasure to see you.
It's great to be here.
And congratulations. Your book was just shortlisted for the Financial Times and Goldman Sachs Business Book of the Year Award, going up against people like Alan Greenspan.
It's tough to go up against the Fed chairman or the former chairman, but yes, we're very excited.
Both you and Ian worked for The Economist. You both left now?
No, we're both still at The Economist. I've been there 15 years, and he's been there even more.
And he covers airline transportation and manufacturing industries. Your beat is environmental and energy issues. So how did you wind up getting together to collaborate on a book?
Well, in a sense, for most of the last 10 years, I've been covering the oil industry, and Ian's been covering the car industry. And we found ourselves collaborating very often, as you could imagine. There may be stories about engines where one has to know about the fuel. I may be writing about biofuels or something, and I need to know what's Renault or Volkswagen doing. And we'd often find ourselves brainstorming informally. And at some point, it occurred to me that there have been a lot of good books written about energy and some good books about cars, but never one that really pulled together these symbiotic twins, these two industries that have been joined at the hip for a century.
You begin the book with a profile of Stanford Obshinsky, who's the co-founder of Energy Conversion Devices, and Amory Lovins, founder of the Rocky Mountain Institute. What are their contributions to the global race to build an energy-efficient car?
I think both of those thinkers, both men are visionaries, and both much misunderstood in their day. Obshinsky, to give an example, he's an octogenarian. 50 years ago, he saw the troubles that would come from oil addiction and global warming. Bear in mind, this was before the 70s oil shocks. He forecast that our use of oil in burning it in a very inefficient way in cars, which is what we do, would lead to trouble. And he had a vision for how we could use renewable energy, converting into hydrogen fuel in vehicles, as well as in terms of electricity systems, and what he calls the hydrogen loop. And I think that's going to be the long-term vision. We move away from dirty fuels towards, ultimately, the sun.
And he claims that the future belongs to hydrogen and only hydrogen. The president said the same thing a few years back, and most people saw that as just a way of forestalling any real change, because hydrogen is so far away.
Sure. And bear in mind that Obshinsky is an energy systems thinker who, long before anyone else began to take the problem seriously, identified global warming, oil addiction, the geopolitics of these things, and the social injustice of these things. The principles on which one argues are important. I think people who are skeptical about President Bush are certainly right, and history has proven them to be right, because when he talked about hydrogen, and hydrogen, just to be clear to those who may not be familiar, it's just an energy carrier. It's like electricity.
We have a hydrogen bomb. Would we be splitting the hydrogen atom?
No. And the hydrogen is made from any kind of energy source. You can make it from nuclear. You can make it from renewables, wind, solar, or you can make it from natural gas or coal. It's a lot like electricity in that way. It's an energy carrier. But if you provide hydrogen to a car that has fuel cells in it, then you can move that car while producing zero emissions. That's why people are interested. That's what Bush was talking about. When he was talking about hydrogen, he said he wanted to have a child born today driving an American-made car, a fuel cell car that's powered by hydrogen. That's when he was widely ridiculed because, of course, he cut the legs out from any of the entrepreneurs or innovators that might have helped bring about that kind of policy by denying global warming, by refusing to act on any kind of environmental policies to do with fuel economy standards for cars. In other words, so there was a rhetoric, but not any of the things that might have supported it. That's why it was right to ridicule. But I think when someone like Obshinsky or Amory Lovins talk about it, they're talking about a holistic approach, including the public policies needed to move from dirty fuels to clean solutions.
Amory Lovins has invented a hypercar, which is powered by a fuel cell zero emissions engine. Now, those fuel cells have been a problem all along because you just require so many, and there's they would take up all the room in the car, wouldn't they?
The problems facing any kind of new energy technology are manifold, right? Hydrogen has all manner of obstacles. Where do you get it? If you go to a BP station or Exxon, you can't say fill her up with hydrogen, right? So there's a fuel infrastructure problem. You say, well, you know, where are you going to get this new technology? If you just get how much hydrogen can your car store on board? But you could say that for electric cars. You could say that for ethanol cars. You know, in New York State, where are you going to get a refuel on your ethanol? There's a chicken and egg problem when you're trying to move away from a combination like the internal combustion engine and gasoline that's been around for 100 years, and you're tackling industries that are multi-trillion-dollar industries that have enormous assets in place. This is exactly the problem one runs up against. But the good news, and this is what Zoom, our new book, talks about, is we don't have to bet on any one of these things. This is not a book about hydrogen. This is a book about a fundamentally different way of thinking about the problem and the multiplicity of solutions that we have now.
And one reviewer called it a call to arms for Americans to demand that the government act now to change its policies regarding global warming and the country's addiction to oil. You have talked about a great awakening. The last great awakening was religious. Are you making some kind of a metaphorical point here?
In a way, perhaps. I think that change in the American political process starts from the bottom up, and we've seen this a number of times throughout the political process. It has appeared the last 10 years that there was gridlock in Washington on energy policy, on climate, on the related issues. And it's a bipartisan problem we have in Washington. The new Democratic Congress hasn't done very much on energy or climate change or anything else for many of the same reasons, the Detroit auto lobby, the concerns from the heartland.
Carl Levin is from Michigan,
absolutely.
And he's going to defend
and Dingell as well from the Midwest. And so it's not a partisan addiction to oil we have. We have a bipartisan addiction, and the lobbying forces in Washington are quite effective on both sides of the aisle. That's why I say the Great Awakening. This is a bottom-up, what I've covered for The Economist over the last decade, evangelical groups, farmers, groups that are plug-in hybrid advocates, that is engineers and nerds, rural electric cooperatives in the middle of America, to environmental groups, of course, as you'd expect, geopolitical thinkers, former directors of the CIA. One of them, Jim Woolsey, was kind enough to give a blurb for this book. I'm seeing a left-right coalition, something that cuts beyond the old political paradigm. That's why I call it a great awakening, because when it comes from the bottom up, it tends to be quite disruptive to the way Washington does business. That's what gives me hope that we can see some change.
My guest is V.J.V. Vaitheeswaran, an MIT-trained engineer. He spent 10 years covering global environmental and energy issues for The Economist. He is co-author with Ian Carson of Zoom, The Global Race to Fuel the Car of the Future. And you write that oil is the problem, cars are the solution. But how realistic is it to envision the American car industry adapting these technologies, given its history?
I think that Detroit has a choice, and companies can either choose to embrace new technologies, and we describe in lots of detail what some of these technologies are. But I think it's perfectly possible that Detroit, some of the car companies in Detroit, will fail. But that's okay. America can succeed, which is the more important point, because we also document how from Silicon Valley to renewable, where there are new car companies like Tesla Motors, which is the first new American car company in 100 years, and they're coming out with an amazing electric car that's going to hit the market early next year. It's faster than a Ferrari. It's made from composite materials. I mean, this is really the kind of technologies we're talking about. That's Silicon Valley money, Silicon Valley engineering. That's not Detroit. Equally, we have companies coming up in China, India, Singapore. If Detroit doesn't lead, someone else will.
But it's interesting that General Motors developed an electric car, and it was much loved by the people who drove them, and yet the GM scrapped it. They recalled them all and destroyed them.
Absolutely. There's a great movie, a documentary movie, Who Killed the Electric Car, that came out about a year and a half ago about this. Californian regulators, who tend to be quite progressive on these issues, forced car makers to make clean cars in the 90s, and GM actually came up with a very cool car called the EV1. It was the fastest, most aerodynamic production car ever made. But most of the organization, it was very schizophrenic. Even though the engineers came up with it, the bosses didn't like it. The guys in Washington who were lobbying said, this is terrible for us. You're showing that we can do something we don't want to do. Ultimately, they undermined it.
Wouldn't that have given them a leg up? They would have beaten out Toyota. Toyota is now making all the points with the Prius.
They never expected the Japanese to come up quite as aggressively as they did. This is the problem with dinosaurs. That is, when a company is as rich and successful and as arrogant as a GM has been historically, you get into the syndrome that, for example, IBM and the big computer companies like Digital Equipment, Wang, these were giants in their day. They dominated the industry. They saw the personal computer and they said, who's going to want something like that? We do it better. We have the ownership of the customers. We all know how that story went when Apple and the distributed computing revolution came. Digital Equipment, Wang, these giants went bust. The dinosaurs were not able to dance. But there are some, like IBM, that were good enough and were able to reinvent their business model. And that's the challenge to Ford and GM and Chrysler. Which of them is going to be like IBM?
But General Motors, you write, in the past 5 years has spent the seemingly awesome sum of $1 billion on research into clean cars with hydrogen fuel cell engines, with no prospect of making a profit in the foreseeable future. So have they seen the light?
I think they're throwing a Hail Mary pass.
Why didn't they just bring back those EVs?
Well, by now, these are 1990s technology. And there was another reason they failed. It wasn't only that GM bosses were Luddites or not green, although I think there's some element of the criticism is correct. They used an old technology that didn't prove convenient for customers. For example, the electric cars in California, you had to charge them at special charging stations. Now, who really wants to do that? It takes hours. You have to sit around without your car. The new Tesla motor car, for example, and the next generation of cars, you can plug into your house into a normal 240 outlet. And overnight, you get a charge. You can go 250 miles. The cars 10 years ago, they could only go about 80 miles. So technology has moved on. That's part of the reason why the time has come now.
When I was reading that quote, the word seemingly awesome sum of $1 billion on research really came blaring out at me. You sound like you're being a little sarcastic here.
Well, $1 billion is a lot of money to me and you, but for GM, it's just a couple of days' revenue. And so it really depends on the perspective of the organization.
Well, you talk about Tesla, but right now Toyota is ahead of everybody. How much credit should we give them for taking the lead in the race to develop a successor to the internal combustion engine?
I think Toyota's done an extraordinary job with taking a risk. They developed the Toyota Prius, which most people will know is a hybrid electric car. It has both electricity as well as gasoline to power it. And it is quite an accomplishment in terms of engineering terms. Here's the thing, though. Although Toyota took a risk, they knew the environment was going to be important. It's now a top 10 car in America. It's wrong to think the Toyota Prius is the car of the future. It's not. If 100% of the world's cars were Toyota Priuses, you might think that's an environmental utopia. We're still 100% addicted to oil because every Prius still uses a lot of gasoline. It's only when we get off of gasoline to alternative fuels or multiple fuels, then we can really talk about changing the game. So it's a stepping stone. It's a very important stepping stone, but that's all it is.
Should I assume that Toyota and Honda are already working on something that would be petroleum-free?
Absolutely.
And it's my sense that their environment would allow for a lot more development than we would see in Detroit because there aren't people saying, no, 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 this is a bad idea.
On the contrary, their environment in several senses. Remember, Japan has no natural resources of any kind, never mind oil or anything else.
Well, they have hydrogen.
But everybody has hydrogen, right? You can make hydrogen from solar energy. You can make it from biomass, hydro. This is the beauty. If you were to go towards a world that went away from oil, which is quite concentrated, towards something else, it could be biofuels, it could be hydrogen, you could never have an OPEC cartel. Imagine the geopolitics of a world where you couldn't have an energy cartel simply because anybody can make your energy source in all manner of ways. That's part of what it means to get off of oil.
Well, we're going to talk about oil as we continue this conversation with Vijay Vaitheswaran. His book, Zoom, written with Ian Carson, The Global Race to Fuel the Car of the Future, is published by 12. Stay with us. My guest is Vijay Vaitheswaran, who has written Zoom with Ian Carson, his fellow correspondent at The Economist. The book is published by 12. We've been talking about cars, and now we come to the oil industry. Obviously, the automobile industry is divided. There are people who really think that they're going to have to make changes. What about the oil industry? You just described them as dinosaurs. All of them?
There are parts of the oil industry that look for life beyond oil. I think the European companies have tended to be more in this camp. Now, I'm quite skeptical when I see claims about oil companies being beyond petroleum or anything like that. Let's be clear. You know, the oil companies are going to be selling oil for a long time. That's their business. That's what they do. If we want radical change, don't expect it to come from the purveyors of an old-fashioned technology. But having said that, I do think that European oil companies are better positioned to provide biofuels or hydrogen, some other fuel to power your car. They're looking at it, how can they become energy companies rather than oil companies? That change has not yet happened in the U.S. oil industry.
Especially with a company like ExxonMobil. I remember the ad campaign they ran that pretty much rejected the notion of global warming. It was that carbon dioxide is good for us. Have they changed their tune?
I think that even at Exxon, which has been the most vocal and most aggressive in terms of challenging climate change wisdom, there are some slow changes. But, you know, I personally had an encounter. Lee Raymond, who formidable former chairman of Exxon, who ran the company for many years, arguably the most financially successful oil man since J.D. Rockefeller himself, chucked me out of his office in a fit because I dared to challenge his views on global warming. And he was arguing that global warming is a government hoax. That's a direct quote from him.
Which government is he talking about?
He meant the U.S. government, the British government, the U.N. I was pointing to all the peer-reviewed scientific literature showing evidence. And he said, these are government scientists. They have a vested interest to keep this hoax going. And so that the company no longer says that, certainly publicly. I think the Bush administration has changed his position. We're at an inflection point, I think, actually, where we can actually get some things done on this topic.
Well, it seems to me that it's in their best interest to go along with any changes because they right now control the delivery systems for fuels. And if they, in the same way that a steakhouse will also serve vegetarian dishes, they might very well see it in their best interest to have alternatives to petroleum products.
Well, not necessarily. I think if what you're seeing is that essentially the car industry has worked out that its troublesome twin is getting to be too troublesome. And the two industries, cars and oil, are headed for divorce. But the divorce is being called for by the auto industry. Most of the good things that people associate with cars, freedom, mobility, transportation, these things come from the car, not the fuel. And so most of the car R&D chiefs have figured out, if we can get another fuel, let's leave oil behind.
But I guess the car industry has been sending out mixed messages. In the 70s, they were talking about fuel-efficient cars, and then over the last 10 years or so, just enjoyed incredible profits from selling the least fuel-efficient cars they could, trucks and SUVs and the like, and only now are paying for their sins, I guess.
That's right. It's actually disgraceful. I mean, the average new car today gets lower fuel economy than Henry Ford's Model T. And that Model T was a flex-fuel car. It could run on ethanol and gasoline. So in some ways, we're returning to a golden era of innovation that we had 100 years ago in automobiles and cars before the symbiosis between oil and the internal combustion engine locked in. We're at an era of great opportunity. What I argue is this is a great race, that there isn't a preordained outcome. Anyone who tells you that it's all about corn ethanol, let's get subsidized that, that's going to be the winner. I'm very suspicious of anyone who claims they know what the answers are going to be. But what I do say is there's going to be a multiplicity of choices that will help us get beyond oil.
And the corn ethanol now has driven up food prices, and we're seeing all sorts of other fallout from that.
Absolutely. I mean, it's disgraceful that we should pick on a crop like corn, which is a very poor crop to make ethanol from. It's very energy poor. It's environmentally damaging to make ethanol from this crop. But we do it because the farmers in the Midwest are politically powerful.
In Brazil, aren't they using sugar? Is sugar any better?
Yeah, I've gone down and investigated this. It's a very much better alternative. Environmentally, in terms of energy, the sugarcane ethanol that Brazil produces is a much better alternative. But to make sure that we don't suffer here in the U.S. and the Midwest, what do? We put up a huge tariff that keeps out the Brazilian stuff.
And in Brazil, you say you cannot buy a gallon of gasoline today anywhere in Brazil?
That's right. 90% of the new cars sold in Brazil are what they call flexible fuel. It can run perfectly well on ethanol or perfectly well on gasoline. And even the minimum blend of gasoline has 20% ethanol. So you can't get a pure gallon of gas anywhere.
So why aren't we doing flex fuel cars here?
We have flex fuel cars, a certain number that are already on the road. The real question is, even if the car is flexible, if you don't have a place to get the ethanol, what's the point? And that's been a little bit of a joke that Detroit's produced some flex fuel cars. There are only a few thousand pumps in the Midwest where you can get ethanol. Will we get a national infrastructure to make ethanol? We might, but not if we rely on this crazy crop called corn, simply because our farmers are very politically powerful. That's the wrong way to go.
But haven't I heard that there are cars that actually can run on used corn oil that's been used to make French fries and the like?
You know, lots of people have jury-rigged their vehicles. Usually it's converted to some kind of biodiesel. Might use restaurant grease or some other kind of Willie Nelson, actually, the country singer, sells bio-Willie fuels. And, you know, in some cases, these might be a reasonable option in localities. There are two problems with them. One, they often burn dirty. That is, they release particle pollutions that can be unhealthy. The second thing is it's really hard to scale up to the size of the national economy using French fry grease. So you're not really talking about a scalable solution that's serious enough to challenge big oil, which is a serious contender.
A listener asks about a company called LS9 that produces a microbe that's been engineered to make oil from sugars. Have you heard about that?
You know, I haven't followed that particular technology, but I would watch the space with bioengineering. There are a number of companies that are working on using microbes to release hydrogen to create variations on biodiesel or biosynthesized petroleum. There's a lot of innovation happening in this space.
Couldn't we also go in another direction and produce more fuel-efficient cars using petroleum? Because an awful lot of the energy just comes out the tailpipe, doesn't it?
You know, I'm an old engineer, and so when I look at cars, I love their design, but I find it disgraceful how inefficient they are. The internal combustion engine, the average car that's on the road today, burns maybe only 15% efficiency. It's pitiful. And if you ask the question, how much of the energy in a gallon of gasoline goes to moving the driver in a forward direction? It's only 1% of the energy in a gallon. We've really designed a colossus of 2,000 pounds that wastes a lot of energy. So efficiency is the first place we should look for savings.
Even while we're trying to find ways to use hydrogen.
The best energy is the energy you don't use.
My guest is Vijay Vaitheswaran. His latest book, written with Ian Carson, is Zoom, The Global Race to Fuel, The Car of the Future. It's published by 12. This is WNYC at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You know, we've been talking about going green for almost 60 years now, haven't we? Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring, and it was a bestseller, and people were convinced, and later we had Ralph Nader, and we've had other people who have been talking about it long before the words global warming became part of everybody's vocabulary. Why is it taking so long? Is it just because our industry is so tied up in this old technology?
Well, let's remember, we have made progress. I mean, when we talked about Silent Spring, we were talking about the problems of DDT, the spray that Rachel Carson wrote about. Well, we've banned that. In 1970, the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland spontaneously burst in flames. It was so filthy and polluted. And we passed the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act. In fact, it was Richard Nixon, of all people, who signed it into law. And on almost any measure, the local air and water is cleaner in America than it was 30 years ago. And the tailpipe pollution, the stuff that leads to smog and heartache for your children, that is much better. The average new car produces less than 5% of the tailpipe pollution of a car from 1970. Now we're talking about a danger we didn't even think about back then, which is global warming. We didn't try to control carbon dioxide. And to this moment in time, the federal government doesn't consider greenhouse gases to be a pollutant. So we have never tried to solve this problem. Once we get serious, I'm convinced that we will solve this problem. But we have yet to get serious in Washington.
And you're assuming that it will happen with the next president. And you have listed five principles that the next president has to adopt in preparation for life after oil in the U.S. What are they?
Well, I think that first, by way of explanation, I think we're at an inflection point. That's why I select this moment in time, because there's an opportunity unprecedented to have a new voice, both in Washington as well as Congress. And in terms of the principles, the most important one is honesty in pricing. It's not going to win me any elections to talk about it, but we don't pay enough for gasoline.
In Europe, they pay a lot more.
In Europe, they pay a lot more. Now, what we propose in this book is a revenue-neutral carbon tax. You might say, well, what does that mean? First of all, we think that basically dirty fuels like coal and gasoline get a free ride in the marketplace. They have a lot of harm that they do to our children's health. We pay for that through the lives of our children or through hospital bills. They harm the environment through global warming. They lead to geopolitical problems through wars in faraway places. We pay for that through our Pentagon budget. But we don't pay at the pump, so it appears to be quite cheap. And most serious economists say the right way to deal with this is through carbon taxes, or which would be manifest as gasoline taxes. I would take any revenue raised and give every penny of it back to every household. That's why I call it a revenue-neutral tax. Every penny comes right back to you. If you own 7 Hummers, you're going to pay more for gasoline. If you own a Prius and a bicycle, you're going to make off like a bandit. What this does is it sends the right signal to the marketplace. Detroit will start making more efficient vehicles. Families might say, why don't we get that Prius, or why don't we get the cleaner car? That's the most important principles. We need to level the playing field so that the clean energy sources, this along with removing all manner of subsidies that we document in the book that are given to big oil and related industries. This is a history of cronyism thanks to Washington politics. We document this, and once we do this, I think clean technologies will have a real chance to take off.
Well, Americans went bonkers when gas went to $5 a gallon.
Trust me, if we continue as we are without a change in policy, we're entering a world of extraordinarily volatile and high prices, and this is only going to get worse. So we need to do something to move us off of oil.
As you point out, the French actually invented the automobile. Why isn't more being done in France?
Europe has lost its mojo when it comes to innovation.
Germans have some pretty great car companies.
Germans have some great car companies, and they do make some wonderful BMWs and Mercedes. But I think if you look at the last 40 years and ask, of all of the disruptive innovations in telecommunications, internet, mobile telephony, biotechnology, almost every single one, except maybe Nokia and cell phones, have come from America. Europe has lost the capacity to innovate. So the way I see it, America is at the heart of the energy problem right now. We consume half the world's gasoline. We're the world's biggest greenhouse gas emitter today. But we're also the world's most innovative economy. We'll solve the problem when we get serious.
And we don't, you suggest, give enough credit to the French, or even though so much of the automobile industry is tied up with the French. Detroit is a French word.
Detroit, Cadillac.
Chevrolet.
Chevrolet, of course.
Pontiac is the French name of the chief of the Ottawa tribe of Native Americans.
There is a delicious irony that so many of these American icons actually come from the land of Brie and what would appear to be the bicycles and berets.
So just a quick recap. You're saying that the answer is not going to come from industry, even though it might be in their best interest. It's not going to come from government because people are afraid to make the hard choices. It's going to have to come from a grassroots campaign?
Well, I think ultimately real change does come from the bottom up. And what we document in this book is that it is already beginning to happen. Don't get me wrong, government and industry will play important roles, but only when empowered by this grassroots revolution I speak of. And we're seeing this. Individuals, organizations, cities, and states are already acting on climate change. They are pushing Detroit and they're pushing Washington to act. We need more of that bottom-up push.
Our listeners obviously want to help. A number of callers have asked how they can convert their cars to electric. Is that possible right now?
Realistically, if you have something like a Toyota Prius or a Honda Insight, not to pick on one company, if you have a hybrid electric car, there are a number of companies that are doing conversions after the fact. The book documents a number of them, in fact. But if you have a conventional gasoline car, you just bought a Chevy, it's a little difficult to convert. General Motors is coming out with a Chevy that's an electric plug-in car, they claim, by within 3 years. So watch this space.
And a plug-in car would be okay because we just plug it into a home outlet?
That's right. The new generation of electric cars would plug into probably a 240 outlet, a drier outlet.
Obviously, General Motors has done an amazing turnabout because wasn't the president of General Motors just a couple of years ago saying that the electric car was a joke?
General Motors essentially took them off the market and crushed them in California, the ones that they had produced themselves. They've been basically shamed into doing it, and in part because Toyota stole the march on them with the Prius. They figure that at least in this area, they can race ahead of the Japanese by getting ahead on the plug-in hybrids and the electric car.
Well, I hope they can, because when they claimed they were going to make a car called the Saturn that was going to be the American version of the Honda, they did a pretty lousy job.
They did. No, but let's remember, Detroit has extraordinary engineers. I mean, that was never the problem. It's the financial men and the bean counters at the top and sort of the short-termist view of shareholders in Wall Street. That's what really drove Detroit to the bottom. But in terms of engineering capacity, including for things like making electric cars, they have the finest in the world. So I have great hope that Detroit can pull off a renaissance. It's just a question of direction from the top.
Vijay V. Vaithiswaran and Ian Carson, who are correspondents for The Economist, have written Zoom, The Global Race to Fuel the Car of the Future. It is published by 12, which is an imprint of Hachette, French. I guess that's why you had all those nice things to say about the French and the car industry. And I want to thank you so much for being with us again.
It's my pleasure.